The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. GI Surgery Review, Indications and Complications, What to Look For, is presented by Dr. Lindsay Morehart.
So, surgery for GERD. We get a lot of consults for this. This is actually reserved for patients with complications from GERD. So they have refractory esophagitis. They're coming in, they've been on high-dose PPI, and you cannot get them off it, and they continue to have esophagitis. Stricture, Barrett's, less common, persistent refluxes, symptoms despite acid suppression, and asthma. So surgical therapy is not generally recommended in patients who do not respond to PPI therapy. So pre-op evaluation, there's not really a great consensus on this, but definitely useful in making surgical decisions would be an EGD. You'd have to have one of those before you get there. Esophageal manometry. We definitely do a lot of these to make sure that the patients don't have achalasia or scleroderma-like esophagus, because if you wrap their esophagus, you might be in big trouble afterwards. 24-hour to 48-hour pH probe, we usually do 24-hour. This is good for preoperative ambulatory pH monitoring. It lets us know if these patients didn't have evidence of erosive esophagitis, to know that their symptoms are actually from acid reflux. For most patients with acid reflux, the Lap-Nissen is the surgery of choice now. It has several advantages with similar efficacy and its safety as an open procedure. Surgical therapy is as effective as medical therapy for carefully selected patients with chronic GERD and definitely needs to be performed by an experienced surgeon. So this is just kind of a diagram of what happens. You can see that they're wrapping around the top of the esophagus here to help with the reflux. So post-op, you can have complications from this. These people might complain of dysphagia if the wrap is too tight. Frequently, they will have dysphagia, but it often resolves. We can use a dilation to help improve this. These people get gas bloat. Again, often resolves over time. If it's mild, you can try something like acetaminophen or charcoal tablets. You should tell these people to avoid carbonation. You can also trial some Reglan. If they have persistent symptoms, you might want to consider that they have gastroparesis. So long-term efficacy, again, if you've picked the right patient, it should be 90 to 95%, and again, in the hands of an experienced surgeon. So in the patients that have peptic ulcer disease, the indication for surgery in these people is failure of non-operative management of ulcer complication and suspicion of malignancy. And this is gastric ulcers. For duodenal ulcers, this is based on reduction of acid secretion, so sectioning of the vagus or vagotomy, eliminating the hormonal stimulation from the antrum, just doing an antrectomy, and decreasing the number of parietal cells. That's a gastric resection. So here we have a Billroth 1 and 2. Billroth 1, just the pylorus is removed. And 2, the greater curvature of the stomach is connected to the jejunum and an end-to-end anastomosis. So the difference from gastric to duodenal ulcer, and I know that Jack touched on this earlier, is that gastric ulcer may harbor malignancy, and therefore, if you have one that you're uncertain about, now we can use EUS, but if that's not diagnostic, you can do a gastrectomy for that. And again, you must biopsy those. Post-gastrectomy syndromes, post-phagotomy diarrhea, dumping syndrome, that's probably one of the bigger ones that we see, alkaline reflux, gastritis, and early satiety. So post-phagotomy diarrhea, about 30% of patients will have this. It's usually self-limiting. They don't really quite understand the pathogenesis of it, but they wonder if there's a rapid passage of the unconjugated bile salts. You can use oral cholestyramine for this. Dumping syndrome, about 20% of patients will have this. Symptoms, you see these patients come in, they have a postprandial abdominal discomfort, they might have nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and cramps. They might have some diaphoresis, palpitations, flushing. The precise mechanism isn't totally understood, but it's attributed to rapid emptying of the hyperosmolar chyme, particularly carbs, into the small bowel. So this leads to a net fluid retention. Then you get the vasoactive hormone release, the serotonin and VIP. So in these people, you need to try dietary changes. Rarely operative therapy is needed. Octreotide might help in these people. The best thing you can definitely do is the dietary changes. So acute cholecystitis. Typically these people are having right upper quadrant abdominal pain, fever, leukocytosis. Maybe they're coming to you before they head to the ER. You're gonna see associated gallbladder inflammation. This is most frequently related to gallstone disease. Complications can be life-threatening. These people can get a gangrenous gallbladder or a perforation. So these people come in, supportive treatment is definitely important. Antibiotics, secondary infection from the cystic duct obstruction, and bile stasis. So the guidelines suggest that we should start antibiotics if an infection is suspected based on labs with an elevated white count, temp elevated, and radiographic findings, you know, maybe air in the gallbladder or wall. And if these people have advanced age, diabetes, immunodeficiency. So timing of surgery. This is one that's important. Asymptomatic gallstones should not be treated. If somebody has gallstones and they're not having symptoms, they do not need to have a cholecystectomy. Low-risk patient with clinical improvement, you can have an elective cholecystectomy in the same hospitalization. If you have a low-risk patient with deterioration, they need an emergent cholecystectomy. If you have a high-risk patient, so ASA classification 3 or greater, the mortality is pretty high, 5 to 27%. These people, if they're deteriorating, you might just want to get a PERT chole tube because they might not be ready for surgery yet. And a lot of times, once they are looking better, more stable, they can end up getting their cholecystectomy. So this is just a little diagram here. So when people have lap choles, we see them afterwards for some of the complications. Some of it can result from the patient selection or surgical inexperience, technical constraints of a minimally invasive approach, because they do mainly try and do these laparoscopically now. Bile duct injury, so it's classified A through E. Repair should always be approached by an experienced multidisciplinary team. This is a really big surgery if someone has a bile duct injury. You may need a diagnostic radiologist, interventional gastroenterologist, interventional radiologist, and definitely a good surgeon. We come in here, biliary leakage. So the patients have a bile leak after surgery. They come in usually with fever, abdominal pain. They may have some bilious ascites, loculated fluid collections. You can do a percutaneous drain on these people with the catheter left in place for drainage, and sometimes that's all that's needed. If it's not improved, then that's when we do an ERCP and we place a stent. That's to decrease the pressure that's flowing, and the bile then drains into the duodenum. We can then pull that in about 6 weeks. So other complications that come from this, obviously bleeding, bowel injury, post-cholecystectomy syndrome. A lot of these people will get bile acid diarrhea. So that may be self-limited, but if it progresses and continues, that's when you can use cholestyramine. It may continue to have abdominal pain or dyspepsia. So we have a 56-year-old obese female. She presents for gastric bypass surgery. She's failed multiple diets and medication. She doesn't have a psychiatric history other than depression due to the condition. She has osteoarthritis of the hips and knees, heartburn after large meals. When you look at her height, she's 65 inches, 230 pounds, BMI is 38. Her blood pressure is 150 over 100. She has abdominal obesity, and she does have a palpable liver's edge. When you look at her labs, her CBC is normal. Hemoglobin A1C is 6.9, triglycerides 250, AST 65, ELK-FAS 140. Ultrasound does show hepatomegaly and fatty change. Which criteria make her eligible for the bariatric surgery? Is it just her BMI alone? Obesity-related joint disease with reduced mobility and quality of life? Her BMI together with the features of metabolic syndrome? Palpable obesity-related liver disease, probable obesity-related liver disease, or probable obesity-related GERD. Yeah, so it's the combination. So BMI greater than 40 or 35 with additional evidence for metabolic syndrome, so diabetes mellitus, hypertension, and or hyperlipidemia. Also failure of prior medical management. And then big thing here is absence of significant psychiatric condition. So that same patient, 6 months after surgery, she had lost a significant amount of weight, but was found to have a significant normocytic anemia with low levels of both serum B12 and iron. What is the likely mechanism for the development of both these micronutrient deficiencies? Does she have an anastomotic ulcer and blood loss, post-op dietary restrictions, small intestinal bacteria overgrowth, or mechanical bypass of the gastroduodenal segment? Yeah, so it's that bypass of the gastroduodenal segment. So iron, when you bypass the duodenum, that's a dominant site of iron absorption. Also, lack of gastric acid leads to decreased absorption of iron. For B12, these people have decreased gastric acid liberating B12 to bind to the R protein. This allows B12 to bind to intrinsic factors. So you're gonna have less acid and suboptimal absorption. So when you're looking at complications from bariatric surgery, obviously early, these people can have bleeding, wound infection. Also an important reason to have their diabetes under control. A lot of surgeons will not do a gastric bypass unless your diabetes is under control because you won't heal correctly. You can have leaks, surgical leaks, PE or DVT, cardiovascular complications, pulmonary, the list goes on. Roux-en-Y and late complications, you can get distension of that gastric remnant. You can get stenosis, marginal ulcers. We see a lot of ulcers, bleeding. These people continue to take NSAIDs. You can have incisional hernia, short bowel syndrome, and dumping syndrome like we talked about before. So stomal stenosis, about 6 to 20%. They question if this is related to ischemia and increased tension on the anastomosis. These people will have nausea, vomiting. They might say they have dysphagia, acid reflux, and this is several weeks after surgery. Usually they just need endoscopic balloon dilation, and that's pretty successful. If they have ulcers, they say 1 to 16%. I think it's higher than that. It's near the gastrojejunostomy. These range in cause from poor perfusion, so just not getting great blood flow to that area. Foreign materials, a lot of times those staples are really irritating. Excess acid exposure, NSAIDs are the big one that we see, H. pylori, and definitely smoking. These people present just like a regular ulcer, the nausea, abdominal pain, bleeding, but sometimes they can have perforation. And you treat it just like you treat a regular ulcer, so acid suppression and then plus minus sucralfate and then having them avoid any offending agent. A sleeve gastrectomy, this is a sleeve of the stomach. You can see that removes a large portion of the greater curve. They're starting to tend more towards these, it seems, as opposed to a gastric bypass. It produces a decrease in the ghrelin levels and reduces your desire for food. There's low complications in these, about 3 to 24%, and mortality is 0.4%. People seem to do better with these. Most common complications, though, you obviously can get bleeding again at the staple line. Most surgeons reinforce the staple line. You can get stenosis as well. This can create a gastric outlet obstruction. You might be able to treat with endoscopic dilation there, or they might need surgical intervention. And gastric leaks, that's one of the more serious complications, about 5.3%. And then these people can get acid reflux. They have less room in their stomach. Almost done. Post-op ileus. So this is a transient inhibition of the normal GI motility in the post-op setting. See this a lot. Being DOs, You might have a good DO in your hospital that's helpful with this. Presumably, the muscle of the bowel wall is transiently impaired and fails to transport the intestinal contents, and typically lasts about 3 to 5 days. So these people have abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting, delay in nutrition, prolonged hospitalization, definitely increased risk of complication with this, and increased healthcare costs. So, you know, poorly understood why these people get this, but the neural reflexes involving the sympathetic nervous system may inhibit the motility. Question of epidural anesthetic agents decrease the duration of the post-op ileus, maybe due to the neural reflexes at the spinal cord level. So exacerbating factors, definitely opioids, intraperitoneal surgery, degree of bowel manipulation is another thing, and then open versus laparoscopic surgery, and then low potassium. Kind of went over this already, absent bowel sounds, lack of passage of flatus or stool, tympanic abdomen, no visible peristalsis. The pain can be mild to severe and constant, and it can present like a mechanical obstruction. So these people might have an abdominal distension, again, tympanic abdomen, and when you're looking at an x-ray, they have air fluid levels or kind of a nonspecific pattern. So you can see kind of the dilation of the bowel here. You can see the air within the bowel there. So treatment, you can use Reglan, erythromycin, don't really show great benefit, laxative, possible benefit. The opioid antagonists may show some benefit, but more studies need to be done in this. Epidural anesthesia, like we talked about earlier. Question of NSAIDs, we don't use that too much. One of the things that we do use is we have a couple old DOs that do some really good manipulation, and we've had some pretty good benefit from them in the ICU. I think the nurses love and hate them. So early nutrition is safe and well-tolerated. Early mobilization doesn't really change much, but might decrease other complications. OMM, like I was saying, and chewing gum